In class, I started the recording a bit late, so I'm going to offline re-record the part that didn't get captured there and try to splice them. So if there's an awkward hiccup a few slides down the road here in this recording, you'll know why. So today we're going to cover the process API that we haven't covered yet, so especially wait and waitPID. We'll talk about open files, redirection, and pipes. We actually won't have time to get to virtual memory. Last time we did a fair bit of review. We did some review of the quiz and signals, and then fork and talked some about exec. So we've covered fork and exec in this API. Just remember that fork makes a perfect copy of the child, everything about the child, except for the PID. And then exec replaces the process that is calling exec with a new program. And here's the syntax for one of the ways that you can call exec. There are many flavors of this. And here you see its use in a code snippet. This is the same code we looked at before. So it's setting up the arguments that will become argv here, and then passing that as one of the arguments for execv. And this will become argv. And then normally we would check for an error after execv. If we get to this code, it means that we had an error. If execv succeeds, this process becomes the new program and we never run this code. And inside the kernel, it's actually setting up fresh memory for the stack and heap and so on. And then once it's done, it deletes the old memory that it doesn't need anymore. So why do we have this split between fork and exec? There are a few reasons. It's not actually fundamentally necessary. So Windows' main way of creating a new program doesn't do that. Combines fork and exec functionality into one system call called create process. POSIX offers something similar called POSIX spawn. And just to make things even a little bit more confusing, Windows does also offer fork and exec in its POSIX compliant subsystem. The disadvantage of having a single call like one of these is that now you need to include in the API everything you could possibly want to change about the process status before you exec, like redirecting files and so on and so forth. And that means that the API needs to be more complicated, but it does allow the OS to avoid the intermediate step of making a copy of the child and then immediately throwing that stuff away to do an exec. So here's an example of POSIX spawn, and you can see here that the API is more complicated. So here's where we get back the new PID. Here's our program. Here are our arguments. Then we also have a way to talk about whether or not the child, the new process that's being created, which becomes the child and the new process together, we'll get a copy of open. We'll get access to open files, some other special settings, environment variables, and so on. So there was a paper written back in 2019, which is a very light, entertaining read, arguing that fork has outlived its usefulness. I encourage you to read it. It offers several arguments. One of them being that when fork was created, when Unix was written, we didn't have multi-threaded programs. And nowadays, having fork possibly happening in different threads in the same process is really problematic. It lists some other reasons. I'd encourage you to read it if you're interested. But now we're going to move on to talking about waitPID, which is another important aspect of the API. And here's where the other part of the recording will pick up. Start the recording. All the previous material was reviewed anyway. And just for benefits of the recording, you know, we covered fork and exec. and now we're talking about Waitmid. So Waitmid specifically waits for a child. And I always make a backup voice recording. So wait and Waitmid can only wait for children. They can't wait for any other process. And that's basically a protection mechanism, right? You wouldn't want me to be able to wait on your processes because that might leak information. I might be able to find out what you've been doing by waiting on your process. So here's an example of Waitmid in use. So again, this is kind of like what you do in a show. So the child PID is going to capture the result of the fork. And then if the child PID is non-zero, we know we're in the parent, and we can wait on the child that we just created. If the child PID is equal to zero, then we're in the child and we do whatever the child does. Typically, it would be an exec. And so graphically, it looks like this. The parent forks and then waits. And the fork creates this child that does some stuff and then eventually exits or maybe gets terminated. And the parent is waiting, if we call Waitmid in a non-blocking way, the parent is waiting until the exit, until the child exits. And then the kernel has a data structure to keep track of the fact that the parent is waiting for the child. And when the child completes, the parent is able to wake up the parent and have it return from the Waitmid system call with the status filled in. Now, you might wonder, what happens if the parent doesn't run right after the fork and doesn't call Waitmid until after the child has exited already? Will the parent hang because there's no child to wait for anymore? So basically, you know, what if the sequence looks like this. So the parent doesn't get around to doing a Waitmid. The child in the meantime exits here, and the parent calls Waitmid later. Well, in fact, after exiting, child status is preserved. So in the kernel, there is a process table with an entry for every process that contains the PID, a place to store the registers when you do a context switch, open files, pointer to the page mappings, and the exit status. And when a process exits or is terminated, you deallocate everything about the process except the entry in the process table. The entry in the process table is kept until the parent or some ancestor waits on the child and collects its status. So after exiting, the child status is preserved in the process table. So that means that even though the child has exited, the parent, when it finally gets around to doing the Waitmid, will collect that status and find out that the child has exited. So unlike with signals, where if you send a signal and there's no signal handler registered yet, the signal disappears. With waiting, even if the exit happens before the Waitmid call, the Waitmid call will do the appropriate thing.
because we have that state, that status stored in the process table. Now you might wonder, what happens if the parent never calls wait and that status is never collected? Well, that information sticks around in the process table potentially forever. And that placeholder isn't using any resources except that slot in the process table. And so we call that, this is a technical term, we call that placeholder in the process table a zombie. And if you actually print out a list of active processes and there's some process that hasn't been waited upon, you'll actually see it listed as a zombie. But this is how we ensure that the PID is never recycled and used for a different process until the parent has called wait. So code-wise, it might look like this. We've got the parent running over here, and it does the fork. And after the fork, we have two entities. Now, they're not copies here. So this is a copy. This is the child. This is the parent. This isn't a copy, so don't assume that that arrow there means we're making a copy of the parent. It just means that after the fork, we now have these two entities. The parent down here at the bottom is waiting on the child. The child, after the fork, can do whatever it wants, and typically that would be an exec. And after you do an exec, then you start at the beginning of main in your new process. Any questions? So just a note about exit. Exit is a way for a process to say, I'm done. And the argument to exit can be the status that you want to return to the parent. In main, if you actually say at the end of main, return, and then an int argument to return, like return zero, the code that calls into main is actually taking that return value from the main and calling exit with that value as its argument. So if I do return zero, then in the CRT.O code that gets linked with your main, we had and we'll just do exit return value. So when you exec a process, there's actually a little bit of stub code that calls main. And after the call to main returns, it just calls exit with the return value from main. A process can also get killed, and the kernel will have a specific value in status that it returns for any kind of exceptional case that caused the process to be terminated without doing a clean exit. So to test our understanding, let's look at this rather gnarly code and talk to your neighbors and see if you can figure out what the appropriate output should be. And in case you're wondering, there's actually a new line here as well. And I want to call your attention to this extra L2 over here. In the last class session, a few people didn't notice that this was here because of it sort of smushed over against the E. So A prints out two things, B prints out three things, and then C prints out two things. So think this code through and figure out which, if any, of those options might be more than one option, would be possible outputs of this program. Okay, so let's go ahead and look at what this program does. So how many people think that A is one of the valid outputs? Okay, how many people think that B is one of the valid outputs? And how many people think that C is one of the valid outputs? And so D, E, and F are just like combinations, so I won't go through those. So the correct answer is E. So let's see why that is. So in particular, B is not a possible answer. So the parent is going to create two children because we're iterating here from I equals 0 to 2. So we're going to do this loop twice. And in the loop, we're going to fork. So we're going to create two children. So we have PIDs with two entries, and we're going to fill this in with child 0 and child 1. So PIDs of 0 will hold the result of the first fork, and that'll be the PID of child 0. I'm just calling it child 0 because it's array entry 0. And then we'll loop up to the top again. The parent will fork again, create another child. We'll call that child 1, and that PID will be captured in this array slot 1. Now notice here that the parent is not doing... let me actually do it this way. The parent doesn't execute this code. This is only code that's executed in the children. So after we fork, if the return value is not 0, the parent doesn't execute this code. If the return value is 0, then that means we're in the child, and the child does these two things. Now, I should say here that echo, the command line utility, just prints whatever its arguments are. So if I'm just at a shell and I type echo foo, what gets printed to the screen is foo. So this child 0 is going to exec, and it's going to pass its argument array that we've set up to this child. And so what the child will see after the exec is that it is running echo, and its argument is whatever we passed in argv. So let's look at what happens with argv. I told you this was a little convoluted. So we initially set up the arguments here, and this args is going to be used down here in the exec call by both of the children. And the arguments, the first entry is always the program name. The last entry is always null. In this case, we have one other argument, and we set it up with a placeholder, the string arg. But, this is the gnarly part, in this line here, we replace args of 1. This is a 1 here. I know it looks a little bit like an I, but we replace args 1, which is this slot, with extra of whatever our I value is. So child 0 is going to take extra of 0, which is L1. So that will become L1. So child 0 is going to echo L1. And then that's all echo does, so echo will exit. Child, now we go back to the top of the loop, we create the next child, and child 1 is going to replace args 1 with extra of I, which is L2 here, so child 2 will print L2. It will echo L2. The parent doesn't print anything. The parent just waits for the children. So as possible output, we don't know what children, what order the children run in. So child zero and child one could go in that order, or it could be child one, child zero. And that means the output is either L1, L2, or L2, L1. But there's no reason that we should get this extra L2 here. So any questions so far? Yeah. So I think the question, let me try to paraphrase, and then you can tell me if I'm doing it accurately. So let's say for example, I equals zero. So child zero gets forked here, and it runs this code, because if we're in the child, the PIDs will be zero, and so I'll set up my args with L1. I'll do the exec and do the echo. And then the question is, does that child zero loop back around and do this again? Is that the question? So this is an illustration of a very important thing to remember. At the instant when you call it exec, assuming that exec doesn't fail, everything about the process disappears and you become the new program. So this is actually what this example was meant to illustrate. Child zero, when it calls exec, becomes echo and forgets about this code. And it just does the echo, it is echo, and when echo is done, that process exits. There's no way for child zero to loop back around and do the I equals one iteration, because after the exec, that child is not running this code. It's forgotten all about this code. It's been completely replaced by echo with the argv of L1. And then similarly, child two, same thing. So that's why you don't get this extra L2 here. Question? So the question was, what if exec fails? So then child one, because we don't have any clever error handling that breaks out of this loop, would indeed wrap around. And then you should get no copies of L1 and two copies of L2 in that particular scenario if the second exec succeeds. Yes. So the question was, is there a way to ensure that child zero finishes before child one? And I'm going to sound like a lawyer and say it depends on what you mean by making sure it finishes before. Because if all we care about is the order in which the parent collects their status, we can wait on child zero before we wait on child one. Now, if we actually care about the order that the output appears, which I'm guessing is what you were really asking about, there isn't a simple way to do that. The children are independent processes. And unless they use something like shared memory to set up a shared barrier object, they're completely independent. They don't know about each other. So did that answer your question? Yes. Yes. So we could hypothetically have wait PID here in the parent code. And then that would be a way for the parent to ensure that child zero runs to completion before child one starts. Good observation. But the children themselves can't sort of say, I want you to finish before I go. The children don't know about each other. So I may have misinterpreted your question. You might have been sort of thinking about what he just suggested, and yes, that works. So, any other questions about this? Yes?
Okay, not to just like make this more complex with having that, but like let's say you do that weight bid, right, and then the exact fails, what would happen in that
scenario? I have to go back over here for the microphones for the recording. So the question was, supposing we had that weight pit in the parent here, and the exec fails. So actually the way, what I should have written here is if to make sure that that's only happening in the parent. So what I wrote a minute ago in orange and then erased wasn't quite correct. And that would ensure that the parent is the only one running the weight pit and the child's not somehow trying to wait on itself. You don't want more wait calls than you had forks. And if the exec fails, you still have the child process existing. It's just, I mean, this code actually is written in a way, because there's no error handling, that it just doesn't work if the exec fails. That's actually the answer to your question, right? Because if the exec fails, even if you get rid of this orange code, it would go down into that for loop below. And then you have too many waits relative to the number of forks, because you'd have both the parent and the child waiting, and you can't actually wait on yourself anyway. So it might work out because the wait pit would return an error because you're trying to wait on yourself, which doesn't make sense. You can only wait on children. But let's go on to another example. Now this one's kind of similar, but kind of different. So if you felt like after our conversation, you were comfortable with the previous exercise, now hopefully this one won't be too different, but there is some subtlety here. And don't get distracted by the F flush. They're actually not that important. Just don't worry about those. So talk to your neighbors, see if you can figure out what the correct output would be. And I want to call your attention to the fact that there are four outputs here, right? This, 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 and this. And the ordering's different, but it's always these four outputs. Just in case somebody kind of loses track of that last column there because it's smashed up against the E, F, G, and H. And maybe I should just clarify again here, we're assuming that exec succeeds.
Oh, yeah, no, that's it.
So let's go ahead and look at this. How many people think A is one of the possible answers? B. C. D. Good. Because the answers are A, B, and C, not D. So why not D? Because the parent here is waiting on the children to complete. So the children are doing their thing. They could run at any arbitrary point in time. The parent could run before the children. The child could run, child zero could run before the parent, and then the child two. Any interleaving of those is possible. And that's why we have 001, 010, and 100. And I should just maybe say, this code is kind of like in the previous example, but without the tricky argument replacement. So, you know, we're forking two children. Each of the children is exacting echo. They're echoing their args, and in this case, both of the children have zero. So we can't print two until both of the children have completed and exited and been waited upon. So if the parent is printing two, the children are done. So there's no way for a child to still be running and print zero after we've printed two. Because any interleaving is possible, but the wait kind of acts like a barrier. And the parent won't go forward until the wait pit is satisfied. And again, we're assuming there's no errors here. So that's why this scenario can't happen. Because if we've printed two, the children are done. Any questions? People are okay with that? Give me a thumbs up. Okay. So moving on to sort of a new topic here. There's all kinds of clever things that you can do with shells. But there are a few that are of particular note. So pretty much any modern shell supports a path variable that will tell the shell when you type a command like ls without an absolute path where to search for that command. So if you just type ls and you don't have a path set up, then it won't run because the shell can't find it. So the shell is smart enough to recognize if there are slashes in there that you're specifying a path and figure out whether it's an absolute or a relative path, but it'll just go look in that one directory and run that program. And if there are no slashes, it says, okay, I need to use my path variable to figure out where this could possibly be. So it'll search in every directory specified in the path environment variable and take the first one it finds. So if you had a copy of ls in slash bin and a copy of ls in slash user slash bin, it would pick the first one. In most shells, the default configuration, unless you change things, it won't search in the current directory, dot. So if you compile something and produce, let's say, a.out in your current directory and try to run it and it fails, that's because it's not looking in your current directory. So typically, you want to make sure that dot is part of your path so that it will always search in your current directory. And so that's why you can just type ls or make or any of these standard command line utilities and they work. It's because the shell has a default path that knows that there are certain common directories where all these utilities reside. You can also run something in the background using ampersand at the end. And what that tells the shell is, don't wait for this program to complete. Immediately return a new command prompt and take a new command. So if I run some long-running command, like let's say I'm processing a large log file and I'm sending the output to a file using redirection, which we'll talk about in a minute. Or let's say I'm using find to search my whole directory, which is many gigabytes, for any file that has a certain name or whatever. That might take a long time, and I don't want my command line to be just not to have a command line while I'm waiting for that program to finish. And so the ampersand lets you run a program in the background. And it does that by just simply telling the shell not to wait for it. Now the shell has to eventually wait for it so that we don't have a zombie. Zombies aren't so bad, unlike in the movies. They just tie up a slot in the proc table, but they don't really use any meaningful resources. But we want to be tidy. And so what the shell will do if you type ampersand is use wait without specifying a PID or wait PID with -1 periodically to see if any background processes have completed. And then it can print the result on the screen when that background process finally completes. We can also redirect input and output, and we can set up command pipelines. So in redirection, what we're doing here with the greater than is we're saying we want the output of some program not to go to the screen, but to this file. And in the second one, with the less than sign, we're saying we want the input for some program to come from this file. So then with a pipeline, what we can do is basically say, I want to create this channel that we call a pipe, and there's a system call for that, where the program on the left side of the pipe can write its output into this pipe object, and the program on the right-hand side of the pipe can consume its input from that pipe. And I can create arbitrarily long pipelines. So I could do something like, and I can mix these, by the way. So what this will do is search the standard input, which is being redirected from log file. So effectively, I'm searching log file for any line with this key. And I'm taking whatever entries match, whatever lines match, and sending them through a pipeline to unique, which will filter out any duplicate entries. And the output of that will be a set of unique entries, which I will sort. And the output of that, I'll send to this program called head, which prints out a specific number of lines from the top of the file. So, this is actually something I end up doing fairly often, searching some output after I've sorted it, and sort only works with unique entries, to find like the top 20 items or whatever. And the general paradigm is typically that you run a program and then you filter it. That's kind of the template that's there in the black text, and there's a specific example of it in the blue text. So let's talk about redirection. So in the kernel, sorry, yes, question. So the path is stored in the shell state, and you can declare new environment variables on the command line by just saying some string equals some value. So these are just string value, key value pairs that are stored as part of the environment. And then as part of forking and execing, you can control whether these environment variables are actually passed to the children. So in theory, you can, in addition to open files, which we'll talk about in a minute, you can pass environment variables as well. But so I want to talk about file descriptors and redirection. So open files are inherited across a fork, and unless you specify otherwise in one of the options to exec, open files are inherited across an exec too. That's about the only thing that is preserved across an exec call. So what do I mean by open files? It's not just the fact that the file is open, but whether I have a handle to it. So in the kernel, there's this proc table. Of struct process info. And in here we've got PID, the register values that we save and restore for context switches, a pointer to the page table, and so on. And this struct of open file descriptors that is a table within the table. So each of the entries in the proc table will have the open FD table within each of these proc table entries. Now, what is an open file descriptor? It's basically a handle that refers to any kind of object that is open for reading and writing. And this could be a file, could be our standard in or standard out, which are typically the keyboard and the screen, respectively. It could be a network socket, could be a pipe, like the command pipeline that we just looked at. And the file descriptor, the FD that you get from opening a file and that you use as an argument in read and write, is actually just a number, 0, 1, 2, 3. It's just an int. Now, I want to clarify here that when you use printf and that family of functions, you're not using an FD. You're using a file pointer, file star, which is actually a struct, and inside it, it contains the FD for the thing that you're reading and writing, and also a buffer, and maybe some other state. But so if I open a file and get a file descriptor, and I use read and write, I'm just using the FD, the int. If I do fopen, then I'm creating one of these file pointers, and I can do printf and scanf and things like that on, actually fprintf and fscanf on that file. So FDs and file stars are related but separate data structures. Now there are, within these ints, there are three special values, 0, 1, and 2. So the 0th entry in that file descriptor table is for standard input. And entry number 1 is for standard output, and entry number 2 is for standard error. So standard output is for the standard output that a process produces. So echo, you know, writes to the standard out, that's just the standard output. Programs can also send messages to the standard error file descriptor. And by default, that also goes to the screen. But separating standard out and standard error lets me redirect the output of a program to a file, but keep any error messages displaying on the screen. And I can actually separately redirect output and the errors to two different files if I want to. The point is just that I have a way to differentiate between regular output and error messages. These are just numbers that point to slots in the table. By default, those slots in the table point to the things that we expect, but we can change that. So, So if I change slot one in the table to point to a file, and then I write to standard out, that output will go to the file. Because slot one in the table is standard out, and I've just changed what slot one is actually describing. Now, if I open a file, I can't just have it directly go into the standard out slot. So open returns the lowest number unused file descriptor. So if I haven't opened anything else and only slot 0, 1, and 2 are used for standard in, standard out, and standard error, and those are active, if I do an open, it'll give me slot 3. And this slide, I kind of talked about this already, but this slide is just saying that an FD can point to anything that you're reading or writing, not just files. So it could be shared memory objects like in the lab, it could be sockets, and so on and so forth. Close will close a file descriptor and free up that slot in the table. So it deallocates that array index. It doesn't affect other file descriptors that point to the same open file object. So it's only when the last file descriptor for a given open file is closed that we actually like close that file altogether or deallocate the pipe, etc. I think you know what a redirection of input and output do. It's important to note here that exec preserves open files. I think we already talked about that. So when we fork copies the open file list, so there's a fresh copy for the child. And then when that child execs, those open files are preserved across the exec. So a typical pattern with redirection is that the shell does the fork, and then in the child, we open the new files, and we'll also typically do a dup or dup2 to set up the open files as the standard input or standard output before we do the exec. And these changes are preserved across the exec. In this way, the output or input redirection doesn't affect the parent because we're only doing it in the child. And this use case is one of the reasons why fork and exec were separated. So that when you write a shell, which was the main way of interacting with the operating system, and this redirection was a pretty important feature back in the day, the shell code could fork, and then in the if clause for the child, it could do any redirection for the child, and it wouldn't affect anything about the parent. So the parent shell doesn't know about the redirection, doesn't care about the redirection, it just waits for the child and then, you know, prints a new command prompt and so on. So it's important to do the redirection after forking. It's pretty rare that you would do redirection before forking because then the parent would be affected. And in the main shell, the parent, in all these examples, if I redirect standard input, suddenly my typing on the keyboard doesn't do anything because the shell is not reading from the keyboard anymore. And if I'm expecting to type stuff at the command prompt, obviously that's bad. Similarly, if I redirect standard output for the shell, all the output, the command prompt, et cetera, are going somewhere else, and I don't get that feedback on the screen. So the way that we transform an open file into standard or standard in or standard out is dup2. So we first open the file, and then we use dup more commonly dup2, to make that newly opened file descriptor, which is some larger number, become what we want, like number one, if it's redirecting standard output. So dup2's semantics are that more dup2 you give it the file descriptor that you currently have, and you then the second argument is the file descriptor you want it to become. And what this will do is it will it will replace that second argument with the information from the first one. So in effect, what this would do in this example that I showed here is it would take the open file descriptor and make it become standard out. So it's important to note that it shares the current location in the file. And if new FD is already allocated, like in the case of standard out, it closes it and then replaces it with the information for the new FD. So here's an example. So we open output.txt and then we dup2 and turn FD into standard out, and boom. Now all subsequent output that goes to standard out, like with printf, will be going to the file. So in the interest of time, I want to get to pipelines, so I'll just skip that slide. So pipelines are a special kind of file where when you make the pipe system call, you're actually allocating a buffer in the kernel that you can read and write. And pipe returns two file descriptors. So pipe, the field zero in this pipe file descriptor is for read, and one is for write. I personally find that backwards, but what I've done here is, again, the same idiom where I allocated a structure and then I pass a reference to it to pipe and the kernel fills it in. So when the system call returns, that value is filled in. And I'm doing that because I actually need several return values, the two file descriptors and a potential error code here, the int. So that's why it's an argument. So now a process can write into the write end of the file descriptor, and another process can read from the read end of the file descriptor, and that's a way for two processes to communicate. So here's an example of this actually happening. We do the pipe call, and that returns our two file descriptors. And we assign the variable readFD to the zero end and writeFD to the one end. We don't need to do these two steps. It's just a way to get a more readable name for these two ends of the pipe. Now in this example, somewhat unconventionally, we have the child writing into the pipe and the parent reading from the pipe. That is not normally the way you would use a pipe. It's possible. But just for illustrative purposes now, we fork, and if we're in the child, we are going to write to the right end of the pipe using write FD. And we can read in the parent from the read end of the pipe using read FD. Now notice we haven't done any redirection here. We'll get to that in a minute. But this is just to illustrate use of a pipe object. Now it's important to note here that that you have to close here the end of the pipe that you're not using, right? So the child is writing, so close read end. Parent is reading, so close write end. We need to do that because the pipe won't complete until the last file descriptor is closed. So if the child exits and the parent is doing a wait PID, but there are extra file descriptors open, then the pipe will, the parent can potentially hang on this read because it hasn't seen an end of file yet. And in the parent, we close the read end as well here because we want to deallocate the pipe after this exercise. We don't need a corresponding close here in the child, because when the child exits, all of its open file descriptors will be reclaimed. So now let's see how this works in a pipeline, and that's where we'll kind of finish up for the day, is this example. So let's say we want to do ls minus l and feed the output to grep so that it only reports the line corresponding to foo. So we create the pipe before the fork because both children need to inherit the pipe. So then we'll fork once to create ls, and then the if ls pid equals zero, make sure that the corresponding code only runs for the ls child. And what we'll do there is we'll dup We'll dup the right end of the pipe into standard out. And so this closes standard out and redirects it to right end of the pipe. Now here we have to close pipe FD0 and pipe FD1 to get rid of extra file descriptors to that pipe because they cause problems. So after this, the only FD that LS has, the LS process has, is the standard out pointing to the right end of the pipe. So we've created this pipe here, and LS's standard out has been redirected to the right end of the pipe. And then we exec LS, and now when LS is running and producing output, that output in LS, LS was written to write to standard out, but in the process that we've created, it inherited the pipes in the child version of that shell after the fork, before the exec. We redirected standard out, then that redirection survives across the exec. So after the exec, when LS is running, it has no idea that standard out is redirected to the pipe, but it just works. Then the parent shell forks again to create another process for grep, and it does the same thing except for the read end of the pipe. And we close the extra file descriptors so that we don't have those causing problems. And now when we exec grep, grep is going to be reading from standard in, and that standard in will be coming from the pipe. And then the parent also has to close . So why doesn't this line here and this line here that close both ends of the pipe destroy the pipe? Because the object persists while there is any open file descriptor. And we've created a copy here in standard out for the write end. And we've created a copy here for the read end. So both the write end and the read end still exist. One of them is standard out for LS. One of them is standard in for grep. But those are the only copies of those pipe. So when LS and grep complete and all files are closed on the exits, then that pipe will be deallocated. So pictorially, what's happening here is the parent creates the pipe. Then each of the children do the redirection and close the unused handles. So pipe is creating these file descriptors 3 and 4. And then we're copying in child 2, which is the grep, we're copying 3 into standard in. And in child 1, which is the LS, we're copying 4 into standard out. So now standard in and standard out have the appropriate ends of the pipe. And we can get rid of the 3 and 4 file descriptors. We don't need them anymore. The pipe is now connected to standard out and standard in. And the parent gets rid of them as well. Okay, so here's an exercise. In the interest of time, I'll just tell you what the problem is. So there's a bug here. And the bug is that this pipe happens after the fork. So that means that the pipe is only visible in the child. That pipe is only visible in, let me say it again. What we've done here, actually I realized there's a slide here, is we've created two pipes. There's one pipe object in the child, one in the parent, and they're different. So if we go back up here, we see the fork. We're not testing for if parent or if child. So both the parent and the child will run that line that says pipe. They will each get different pipe objects because each call to pipe produces a new pipe object. So always make sure, this is my final comment, always create the pipe in parent and then redirect in the children. Okay, that's a good stopping place. Thanks, everyone.